Greg. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview with the Thinking Working Politically Community of Practice. I am thrilled to have this opportunity to speak with you about your new book, Inside the Political Mind: The Human Side of Politics and How It Shapes Development. But let me start by introducing you briefly for the benefit of our audience. Greg Power is not only a great name, but also a perfect aptonym, I think, given that he has been working on understanding the politics of development for the better part of 3 decades. I have not known Greg all that long, thank goodness, but Greg and I have been fellow travelers on this Politics Matter journey for some time, and it has been a pleasure to get to know him and collaborate with him over the years. Greg is a founder and board member of Global Partners Governance, and he has been involved in political and parliamentary reform since the mid-1990s. Before setting up GPG in 2005, Greg was a special advisor to British ministers Robin Cook and Peter
Hey.
Hayne, working on strategies for parliamentary reform, constitutional change, and the wider democracy agenda. Greg has worked extensively in countries across the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, Central and Eastern Europe, and Latin America, advising both politicians and ministers, as well as international development organizations. Drawing on this experience, Greg has just published this book, Inside the Political Mind, which explores how norms, public expectations, and the personal interests of politicians influence the path of political development. And I should also say that the book has been getting rave reviews from the Financial Times, The Guardian, and also from former Secretary of State for International Development, Rory Stewart. So all this very exciting. Well done, Greg. Tell me, why this book? Give us, if you have it, an elevator pitch about what it's about, how it came about, and what you're hoping to accomplish with it. Did you have a specific audience in mind when you were writing it?
I was going to say, Alina, it's lovely to be with you again. We should probably stop there because I'm not sure it's going to get much better than that introduction from here on in. So thank you for that. It's very kind. Yes, the book is has been, you and I have been talking about this sort of stuff for a long time. And the book is a product of, I think, partly a frustration that even despite the great strides that the Thinking Working politically movement has made over the course of the last 10, 20 years in inserting politics into development, there are still, I think, a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of misconceptions about politicians specifically, what politicians do, why they do it, and why it matters. There's still a tendency to resort to caricaturing a lot of politicians, often seen as venal, self-serving, manipulating voters. There's still a heavy reliance on clientelism for describing what politicians do locally in particular. And actually what the book is arguing is it's much, much more nuanced than that. And if you're only if you're only looking for clientelism, that's all you'll find. But actually what's going on is something much more nuanced, which relates to social norms, public expectations, a sense of reciprocity between voters and their politicians. And this matters for three reasons. I think there are three key points in the book. Firstly, rather, when you look in from the outside at what how politics works in a different country, often you focus on the things which you don't recognize, and there is often a tendency to think that's a bit weird. You know, why are politicians behaving that way? The first point is there is always a logic to political behavior. It might not conform to what you think they should be doing, but there is always a logic there. There's a quote in there from a guy called Rory Sutherland from his book about psychologic, which is that you should never denigrate a behavior until you've worked out what purpose it really serves. And that's the first key point in the book. The second point, which relates to that, is that political institutions, this matters for development because political institutions only tend to get stronger when politicians want to make them stronger. It's the politicians themselves which will accrete power to their institutions. The problem is, in many of the sorts of places in which we work, they don't want to do that because they know how to get elected. This short-term imperative, they know how to work the system. And often it's that there is a tension between the formal institutions of politics and the highly informal political culture that operates in many, many places. So politicians, there isn't an immediate incentive for them to strengthen their institutions. Often it's away from their institutions to keep working informally. So that's the second point. And then the third is that the third part of the book. Well, how do you align those short-term imperative political imperatives with the longer-term objective of trying to strengthen those institutions in places where they really need stronger political institutions? It's the mother of collective action problems in that sense, about aligning the short-term with the long-term. And the book draws on behavioral economics, comparative politics, development, change management theory to look at how you might do that. And hopefully along the way, you know, there are some interesting stories from the sort of 60 plus countries in which I've worked for the last 20 years.
Thank you so much, Greg. That's a really great overview, I suppose, of the book and some nuggets there that I want to pick up on. I think it's fair to say that politicians are perceived very negatively across the board. I mean, this is something that you were saying, that there's a perception that they're venal, that they're self-centered, that they're corrupt. I don't think this is something that only international actors characterize them in this way. So can you share with us a story or a nugget of when politicians act in a way that is intended to work with others, support others, be it their constituents or other stakeholders? What some good aspect of the work that politicians do that we may not know or be aware of?
Well, I think it's, I mean, there are, the examples are sort of legion, and in some ways it's difficult to pick on one or two. I mean, I've worked with hundreds of politicians over the last 20 years, and the vast majority of them go into politics because they want to achieve something. You know, if you didn't want to do that, you could find other ways of serving yourself or making money. There is often something which drives people to seek election, to get elected to public office. So the motivations for a start, I think, are the first thing. But the second thing is that it's not just about the politicians. If we take the just going back, the logic of clientelism, which is often used as a way of looking at what politicians are doing, the assumption is that whatever they're doing locally has to equate to vote buying, that they are giving people money, getting them jobs, using their connections to sort problems out, and that this is somehow wrong. As I said earlier, it's much more nuanced than that, because in order to get elected, politicians to some extent have to do what the public expects them to do. It's not just the individual politicians who are trying to, you know, it's often not the manipulation of gullible voters by wily politicians. Actually, where parties are weak, where the system is weak, it's often a sign of the weakness of the political parties comes out in the fact that they're having to respond to what voters are asking them to do. The problem is where the state doesn't function, you know, individual citizens, electors, voters will need stuff immediately. So that's what politicians focus on doing, because ameliorating that problem in the short term is what their voters need and want them to do. What they would like, if you ask them, all the polls show this from Afrobarometer and elsewhere, what they would like is a stronger system. But actually getting to the stronger system often means giving up those short-term benefits now. So the politicians themselves are often locked in this cycle. And if you talk to politicians, they will talk about the importance of having to show that they have money, that they have wherewithal. That's how they get elected. They need to show that, because if you don't show that, people are much less likely to think you can deliver stuff once you are elected. So money plays a very important part of that, but it's not a simple transaction. It's much more complex than that. And it's like the analogy that I use in the book, and this is one that one of your tutors or heroes, Guillermo O'Donnell, has touched on in the past. If you look at the way that traffic works in different countries, there's a real parallel with politics, because if you're driving in another city, the road furniture is going to look pretty similar wherever you are in the world. There's usually white lines in the middle of the road. There are normally stop signs and traffic lights. The way you drive is very different. Learning how to drive in another place is learning what's going on. What are all the norms and assumptions that other drivers are making in this place? And what often happens, where the traffic system is bad, drivers look for shortcuts. They will, you know, find ways of getting around the system in order to get to their journey as quickly as possible, because that's what they need to do today. In doing that, they're often making the situation worse for everybody, including themselves, because you're just increasing the number of traffic jams. And if you ask them what they'd like, is a much more logical transport system, traffic system, where the flows are much more normal. But they have no power to do that. So what they do is they focus on how do I get as quickly as possible to my journey today? And that's what politicians are doing in almost all of the places in which we work. They're trying to work out what's the shortest way I get to my destination today. But they're making their own lives more difficult, as well as those of their constituents in the long run, because they're not solving those problems in the long run.
Well, I love that you mentioned O'Donnell, and I also saw that you cite James Scott in your book. So that's brilliant. And I also really like this analogy about the traffic. What I talk about a lot is traffic lights. You know, depending on where you are, you will stop at the red light or not, right? And you better know which countries obey the traffic rules as are, you know, ascribed by the red lights. And where you need to sort of be more careful about that. So I really like that. I wanted to follow up perhaps on this and the really important point you make about the fact that the behavior may not seem logical, but it's deeply rational based on where people are. And I think one really important point that you make in your book is that individuals matter more than formal institutions, and that focusing on formal institutions on their own or formal rules on paper is not sufficient to change behavior and the way power is transacted, much of which happens in much more informal ways. So can you tell us a little bit what this implies for institution building? And I'm thinking here, the rules of the game, both formal and informal, and what institution building from the inside, as you have put it, actually looks like in practice.
Sure. Well, I should mention before we started this, we were talking about swearing. So I'm about to swear, just so you know, because it appears in the book. But there's a joke, but the British comedian Arthur Smith told this joke probably a couple of decades ago about the English cricket team when it had a clutch of good players, but kept losing matches. And his line was that the cricket team was good on paper, but shit on grass. Now, that's the case with, I think, an awful lot of political institutions. And my experience has been shaped, you know, by we've been working with the Iraq Parliament since 2008, but I've also been to, you know, after the Arab Spring, we were involved in Egypt and Libya and bits of Afghanistan and elsewhere, where there very much was a sense of, well, you need a certain, you know, type of institution in this place. In many ways, Afghanistan was the peak of that. And, you know, if you look at what the international community were trying to create institutionally and constitutionally in Afghanistan, it was a raging success because they did pretty much create the constitution and the institutions that they were after. The problem was they didn't take any of the people inside those buildings with them. The politics remained exactly the same as it was. It wasn't touched by the institutions. And there has been a traditional assumption, which we're moving away from over the last decade or so, that what countries with poor governance need is institutions like they look in Western Europe or North America. Actually, what you need is institutions which solve problems for the politicians and the staff and the ministers and the civil servants inside those institutions so that form follows function. You know, if you think about one of the books I reference is Henrik's book, The Weirdest People in the World, where he talks about Western educated, industrialized, rich and democratic, and the sense that if you're looking at it from that, the world from that perspective, things do look weird. Actually, we are the weird ones. Trying to insert institutions like that in another country is never going to work the way that it did has done in Europe, because those institutions didn't come about as a product of rational planning. They came about as a process of what he calls myopic groping, just trying to fix problems in the short term. Those turn into norms and practices. They then become legislated and they turn into formal institutions. They were a solution to a problem. And that's what we're missing. I think our approach very much in all the work that we do is starting with the individuals inside those institutions who ultimately have to make them work in the long term. And all of our work starts with two questions, which is what are you trying to achieve? How can we help you achieve that? And you're trying to find fixes for those problems which really matter today, but in ways of strengthening the institution so those same problems are easier to solve tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Greg. I think that's super important. I think the fact that there's so much focus on what institution form should be, irrespective of whether or not those formal institutions meet the needs of those who are intending to use them, is really, really crucial. And this issue about understanding the functionality that some practices that we may perceive, as you were saying, as corruption or vote buying or what have you, the functionality that they have to solve everyday problems, right? So you end up having situations where people feel that they have to, that that's the only option they have. So there's a functional issue there that you really have to take into account. I wanted to ask you, because I think we agree very much that that formal institutions on their own are not enough to change behavior. But I also feel that, and you probably agree with this, that there's a real interactive dynamic between individuals and formal and informal institutions, or the rules of the game, let's call them.
Mm-hmm.
And that these will be very important in terms of shaping the behaviors, the incentives, the interests, and the environment within which individuals operate, right? Can you tell us a little bit what that implies in terms of what politicians actually care about, what drives them, and what actually does shape their incentives and their behavior?
It's a, there's a quote from Churchill in there towards the end of the book, that Churchill's famous comment that we shape our buildings and afterwards our buildings shape us. But at the beginning of the book, there's a chapter which is about why parliaments fight. And if you go, there's a website called Parliamentary Fights, I think it's called, which is basically YouTube footage of MPs knocking lumps out of each other. And the sort of tone of the website is, well, this is sort of an aberration. Look at these silly people fighting each other.
Did you see Mexico there? Because they actually have quite a lot of fistfights.
I think, yeah, Mexico, I think, is in there. And the book goes through examples from Jordan, where somebody, there was actually one MP tried to bring an AK-47 into the parliament at one stage, through I think, Ghana, India, Albania. There's very interesting footage of a fight in Albania where there's just a melee in the middle of the plenary session, and you can see one MP who's carrying a 40-inch flat-screen TV towards where the Prime Minister is sitting. Now, he got stopped. God knows what he was going to do with this thing if he got anywhere near the Prime Minister. But anyway, leaving that to one side, the serious point about that chapter is that actually the book makes a distinction between what the rules say and what the rules mean. Now, in many of the places in which we worked, where, you know, if you take Libya or Iraq, you know, the institutions being created there, all the new politicians had to go on was what the rules say. There was no culture of parliamentary politics. There was no sense about how to engage with each other. There was very little trust between any of the politicians who'd been elected. And they all had very different ideas about what they should be doing and how the institution should work. Now, that working that out, working out what the rules actually mean in practice, is often a process of real friction, of testing the rules almost to destruction. And often, you know, you are testing them literally to destruction because the institutions fall apart. But this is what happened in the UK. It's what happened in the US. The history of Westminster is littered with fights because people were disagreeing about what the rules meant. And the point that I make in the book is that rather than seeing this as an aberration, it is a necessary part of giving the rules meaning. Interpreting all rules, all laws have to be interpreted at some level or another. And the thing about what this means in terms of development and how you strengthen institutions is to understand that in many of the places on that website, they are only, I don't know, 5, 6, 10, perhaps 12 electoral cycles into what looks like democracy. These are relatively new institutions. They're still arguing about what the rules mean. The point at which fights tend to break out is when a disagreement about policy, they often start about disagreements about policy where you've got one side arguing one thing and another side arguing something else. But when they turn nasty, tends to be when there's a perception that the other side is somehow cheating, somehow bending the rules or trying to get a, you know, pull one over the other side. And you can see this in, you know, Trump's presidency in the US was characterized by this. A lot of people didn't like what he stood for, but they really didn't like the way he went about it because they thought he was just, you know, getting rid of the rules. Similarly with Boris Johnson, ultimately his demise was down to the fact he didn't really seem to think the rules applied to him. Or Brexit, you know, the issues in Brexit were very powerful to start with, but it became really toxic after the referendum because the Brexiters thought the Remainers were trying to overturn a legitimate decision, whilst the Remainers thought the Brexiters had only won that by, you know, deception and lies. And that's where the real toxicity comes from. So that process of getting to what the rules mean is a necessarily conflictual and argumentative process, but that's ultimately what gives the rules meaning. And then, you know, politicians, political institutions, and this is where I sort of draw on James C. Scott a bit in the book, is that institutions don't function simply because of what the rules say. They function because of all the norms, assumptions, institutional patterns, the stuff which, you know, like driving, what's going on in the head of other drivers in this place? What are the norms here that you're working with? That's how institutions are given their real meaning and how they learn to function effectively. But that is a long, drawn out and often conflictual process.
Yes, I mean, fascinating, because this issue about contestation, and even today in the most established democracies, as you were saying, you see that there's this contestation going on and norms are shifting. The threshold of what we thought was possible, you know, some time ago is now very different, and all of that. So, but I wanted to sort of get a sense from you, and I guess you have experience from such a broad array of countries and regions, including also the UK. Would you be able to say in a very general way, are there specific things that drive politicians, that politicians care about? What is it that shapes their behavior and their incentives most, would you say? I mean, this is, I don't know if it's possible to generalize at that level, but is there something that drives them? You know, because you're talking about the importance of understanding the incentives, but what shapes those incentives? What is it that they care about and why?
My general feeling is that, as I say in the book, that most politicians go into politics because they want to achieve something. It's not just about them. You know, it's not about earning huge amounts of money. It's about trying to achieve something. The problem is that politics is ultimately about power and a contest for power. And you wouldn't be in politics unless you wanted to get the power to do something with it. Now, from there, I mean, it could, the politicians that I've worked with are motivated by a whole number of different things, you know, to get into it in the first place. Where you have constituency-based electoral systems, they are often driven, once they're in the job, by responding to what constituents are asking them for, because that's how you get elected. And the key thing is, if you're asking what ultimately drives most political behavior, the key point is, I need to get re-elected next time. If I'm not re-elected, I can't do anything. So what do I need to do to get re-elected? Now, this is often looking in from the outside, and so sometimes from civil society, there's a sense, well, this is sometimes, you know, a dirty motive that politicians have. But ultimately, if you're not elected, you can't do anything at all. And that's not to say that politicians, in terms of their behavior, is only shaped by a sense of, I have to do the thing which is going to get me elected. But a smart politician will always be thinking, with every new issue, okay, what's my take on this? What is it going to do for my chances at election? And there's a difference between those two interpretations. The vast majority of politicians are in that second camp. They have to be thinking about what it is that is going to affect my chance. How is this going to affect my chances of election? But what they do about it is then shaped, as I say, by a whole series of voter expectations, social norms, cultural mores, a sense of, just to take one example, in a couple of places, the later chapters of the book look at a bit of Malawi and a bit of Indonesia. And in both of those places, the politicians that I spoke to completely dismiss this idea that it's just about money. They were saying, yes, it's important. You know, you have to show that you've got capacity, resources that you can use to help citizens. But often in places, you would be breaking a social norm if you pointed out what, you know, the amounts of money that you've been given to people. They would be breaching those norms and people wouldn't vote for them for that reason. And in Indonesia, there's a very interesting study, which I refer to, where it was summed up by a quote from a voter who was saying, look, people, you know, it's difficult to buy people's votes here, but you have to give people money, in the sense that you have to show that you've got the money. But if there was a direct transaction, you would probably have a problem at the voting booth. And it's summed up in the quote, look, I think money is important, even though it's really important, was the summary of that.
Sorry, what is the quote? Money is really important, even though it's really
Even though it's
important.
not very important,
Oh, okay, even though it's not very important. Okay.
yeah.
It's like we could have ham and eggs if we had ham, if we had eggs or something. let me push you a little bit on that. I mean, there's if I take what you're saying, there is in what you're saying some optimism actually about the electoral connection between elected members of parliament or elected people who win elections and their constituents. And there's this desire and necessity to respond to them, which is the logic of democracy, right? So that you seem to think that this is at least a plausible, if not rather present dynamic, which is very good. But I wanted to ask you, presumably MPs and other politicians have a lot of constituents. So who is it that they listen to more or less and why? Who has access and influence? And how do they navigate? How do politicians navigate this? Because I'm assuming they cannot, satisfy everybody. So who do they tend to listen more or less to and why?
I'll take your question two parts if that's okay. I mean, on that second part, it varies hugely because it depends on the electoral system, and it depends ultimately if you're going to get elected, you need to get selected in the first place. And every country has different ways of selecting their politicians for the election, which creates, as I explained in the book, all sorts of different sort of permutations and often counterproductive incentive structures. But you, I mean, in a constituency-based system, once you know if you're selected for the party and standing in the constituency, you have to show that you are respond the good part. Going back to the first part of the question, the positive part is it's a highly responsive form of politics. You have to show that you are responding to what your constituents are asking you for. The in list systems where you have a proportional system and it's determined where you are on the list by the people at the top of the party, your allegiance is going to run in a different way. Because in order to get elected in the first place, you need to be doing what the people at the top of the party want you to be doing, which has another distorting effect. Where the positive stuff is, going back to that first part of the question, is there are glimmers of politicians starting to do things differently. The problem with giving people what they want, giving people money, finding them jobs, is it's really expensive, it's really inefficient, and it's often very ineffective. Because there was a Tanzanian MP summed it up for me, who said, "Look, most of the time, each day, I'm giving people money because I know that a lot of the people come to me for ask money. If I don't give them money, they're not going to eat today. So what else can I do?" And that refrain, "What else can I do?" reverberates in almost every conversation I've had with a politician. They feel like they're almost trapped in this cycle. But that Tanzanian politician also said, "Look, I know it's not solving the problem because I know that that person I give money to is going to have to come back tomorrow or next week or 2 weeks later or a month later to ask again. But more than that, they're going to go and tell their friends, the MP helped me. They will come to me for money. And so I'm increasing demand without the ability to increase supply." There needs to be a more strategic long-term solution. Now, what's happening in a number of different places is just the sheer cost and complexity of doing that work is forcing politicians into different ways of doing this. So in Ghana, there was the example of, MPs being asked to constantly buy paper medical bills. And this has resulted in certain parts of the country setting up community hospitals. So rather than giving each individual person who comes to you the money for their bills, you're trying to get a collective solution which gets to all the people in the community at the same time. Or in Uganda a few years ago, during a budget debate, one MP stood up and said, "Look, I'm spending a huge amount of money buying ambulances, or because we have no ambulances, I'm having to pay for people to get to hospital or get dead bodies from the hospital." And in that debate, it resonated with other MPs. And despite the President Museveni's very strict instruction, "Vote for this budget, this is the government's budget, we expect you to vote for it," what the MPs then did from the NRM, from the governing party, moved part of the defence budget and put it into health. So to try and get a strategic solution. And it's the sort of catch-22 element of that problem, which is forcing politicians to do things in a slightly different way and look for those strategic solutions. The challenge is convincing voters that if you're not giving them money today, you have what is called in the book other credible currencies that you can convince your voters that I'm not going to give you money directly, but this is going into something else which is going to help everybody in the short, medium and long term. And again, if you look at the Afrobarometer studies and others, if you ask people what they want, they do want that development. They don't want the handouts. They want the development. It's just that they don't necessarily trust the politicians to give them that development if they're not giving them the handouts. And that's where the trust and rebalancing that relationship between voters and MPs is really important.
Yeah, and I'm imagining that, individual voters voting in elections every several years have some power, but limited power. And you were talking about the money and how important it might be. And I'm wondering what might be other factors or drivers that are important in shaping what politicians do. And I'm thinking, for example, of the role of organized crime across regions, really, capturing politics. They don't want to be physically seen officially as running the country, but behind the scenes, they might as well be, right? So what is that? Can you tell us a little bit about that? You are focusing a lot on politicians wanting to respond to their constituents and voters, the power of voters and that electoral connection. But I'm wondering, about perhaps bigger forces that also are important for politicians and they take into account. And in this case, for example, money, whether it's licit, a lot of money goes into politics, and you influence politicians in that way through a legal official way, but also through, the huge amounts of sums of money and other carrots and sticks, if you will, that organized crime, for example, presents politicians with. So can you tell us a little bit about those bigger pressures and how they came about in your book, if they do?
I don't touch on it hugely. It's certainly not really on the organized crime overlap between that and politics. But there is a large part of the book which is about how, one of the chapters is about how the history of machine politics and how clientelism works and how it changes. Because, again, looking at Europe, North America, machine politics is a phrase which comes from the USA. Large parts of European politics were and still are highly clientelistic in the way that they work. And the chapter looks at how, if you take it, it focuses on South Africa and the parable of the ANC in many ways, which went from being one of the most, possibly the most fated liberation movement and widely supported liberation movement in the world, to one of the most corrupt and venal and dysfunctional political parties, because the way in which the party started to eat the state. And what you're ending up with, the point of that chapter is that at a certain point, the costs of operating that way become too high for the people involved in the system to actually sustain it. And once there is an alternative to that, once there is a better way of doing it, which doesn't involve corruption, which doesn't involve clientelism, politicians will take it and take it very quickly. But for as long as there isn't an alternative, for as long as, lots of people are benefiting from it, from, a tight system. And you can see this in many, many countries where a central cohort of politicians are clearly benefiting from the fact that the state is highly corrupt. They will do everything that they can to keep that going because they are personally benefiting from it. At a certain point, though, the state tilts over and collapses because, as we're sort of seeing in South Africa at the moment, we've got an election coming up in South Africa in the next couple of weeks, and it's a test for the ANC. The ANC is fracturing in all sorts of different ways as a result of that because, quite simply, the state is not delivering to its citizens what the citizens expect the state to deliver. And at that point, everything is up for grabs.
Yeah, it's the year of elections everywhere, so we're all holding our collective breath. let me perhaps switch gears a little bit and ask you, a sort of in our world in international development and sort of with this important emphasis on the fact that It's not just the formal rules, it's the informal rules, institution building as a way that you have talked about it. Where have you seen interesting examples of international actors actually supporting efforts to promote political change that are more attuned to those realities and have responded more effectively? Are there examples? And if there are examples, what has enabled those international actors supporting these efforts to do that?
I think, sadly, there's more examples of it not being done well than it being done well. And I think most of the examples of where it has been done well are the ones which most of the TWP community will know about already. The sort of stuff that the Asia Foundation has done, the stuff that ODI was looking at in the last decade or so. There are all sorts of examples, and they are about, you know, the politically smart, agile, adaptive programs. To sound slightly depressing, it often tends to rely on very talented and politically astute individuals sitting at the center of those projects, but also the funding mechanism giving them enough flexibility to make mistakes and to iterate. And we've had ups and downs with this. I mean, our work is funded by a whole variety of different international development agencies, all of which have their strengths and weaknesses, but all of them ultimately have to justify what they're doing to the taxpayer at some point. So there is a tendency to show us impact, show us value for money. The unit cost needs to be driven down. Actually, that often restricts your ability to do stuff which is genuinely politically agile and genuinely adaptive, because the again, as I say, in the last part of the book, there's four broad principles which I say need to govern these sorts of projects when you're dealing with politics. The first is individuals over institutions. Focus on the individuals. But I mean, I've had this conversation in the last week with one of our funders saying, well, can you show us an institutional effect of this? How have you changed some rules? I'm saying, no, you're looking at the wrong thing. That you need to be thinking about behavior. Ultimately, the rules are a sort of nudge, but the impact comes from, are politicians doing things slightly differently, and are they going to sustain those things? So individuals over institutions. Secondly, personal interest and political principle. The point that I make in the book is that the history of political reform, it looks at a lot of the UK and Westminster, the history of reform is often those changes which help politicians to do their jobs better and often have a personal benefit for them, but also give them the chance to stand up. There is a principle involved here, and I'm doing this because of the principle. Now, that sounds duplicitous and deceptive, but it's true of almost all change in every institution. There needs to be some sense in any organization when change is in the air, your first thought is, how is this going to affect me as an individual? You might believe in the principle, but if it's going to make your job more difficult, you're going to think, well, do I want to do it this way? And the thing about politicians is that they control how their institutions run. So you need constantly to be appealing to both the altruistic and the egotistical sides of the brain at the same time. The third is reciprocity as a tool for reform. Understand that politics is a huge network ecosystem of reciprocal altruism operating at many, many different levels. If you take something out, the sense of reciprocity shifts, and you often have to have that balance. That sense of what's in it for me is often a key question for not just for politicians, but also for voters as well, being willing to shift. And then the fourth is think big, act small. There is a tendency, Duflo and Banerjee's work on development is very interesting in this. And they sort of make this point that a lot of international assistance, and I think everybody sort of listening to this, watching this, will be familiar with going through a project document where you have to promise to do all sorts of things in the next 4 years. And you'll get asked by the funder, have you done this? Can you insert something on that? Can you put something in there? And the way they sum it up is that often development projects are premised on the basis that we shouldn't do anything unless we can do everything. You have to be promising to cover all sorts of things at the same time. Well, actually, it's the very discrete targeted projects which are often far more effective. They don't promise to do everything, but we're going to get change in this small space. But if we can get change in this small space, you've got a model, you've got a proof of concept, which you can then replicate elsewhere. And that's what we're aiming for. But for all the reasons that we know about in terms of aid budgets, management and minimizing administration, there is still a preference for bigger budgets rather than smaller ones, which might generate that sort of innovative entrepreneurial change.
International development actors also have a lot of constituents that they have to keep happy. And they're also sort of,
absolutely,
they're also trying to navigate in perhaps not the most efficient ways, figuring out what to do. So that's actually really interesting. If there is a key lesson or message that you wanted to leave with the Thinking Working Politically community of practice fellow travelers like yourself and me, what would that be?
I go back to where I started. I think the key point of the book is that political behavior is always logical, but possibly not rational, in the sense that you need, as I said earlier, never denigrate behavior unless you've worked out what purpose it really serves. There will be a reason why politics works the way that it does in a particular country, rather than assuming they're doing it wrong. Work out, you know, or that it doesn't make sense, work out why it does make sense to the people who are doing it. Once you've got that, you've then got the basis for building reform. And as the title of the book comes from that central principle, that all political change has to start inside the political mind, understanding what is logical to the politicians who are doing it, and it needs to work outwards from there, and that's the institution building from the inside. Working with the logic that is currently there and seeking to tie that short-term logic with the long-term strategic objectives of strengthening governance.
Thank you so much, Greg. That was fantastic. And I think
pleasure.
With your last point, I can say that that's exactly what at least the thinking part of thinking working politically is about, understanding why things work the way they do and have that logic, and not think about, oh, well, this should look like that because, you know, otherwise it's completely rational. So that very much resonates with the community. And thank you so much for your time.
Brilliant. Thank you, Alina.
Much success.